Hey, can everybody see and hear me all right? Testing 1, 2, okay. For those who are listening to the recording of this, my apologies. I started recording. I was trying to turn on the camera, and I wasn't thinking, and I hit the button to start the recording. And there's a 95% chance if I stopped it and then started it again, I would be able to save the right part, but on the off chance that I give the whole lecture and somehow it saves the 2 minutes in the beginning when I recorded the wrong segment, I think it's safer just to let this run. So if you're listening to this recording and the tech guys after the fact aren't able to splice out this part, you may just want to advance it 4 or 5 minutes or so until the main lecture starts. But right now we got 3 minutes before the class time officially starts, and I accidentally hit record. So for those of you who are tuned in here, if you're want to ask questions, feel free to start typing those into the Q&A box, which is presumably going to be a lively lecture, a very hot button issue on drug prohibition. Okay, for those who are trickling in here, we're going to get going in about 1 minute. I'm just going to step away from the camera for a minute. Let me just look up one little thing from the textbook. I just need to refresh my memory as to how I made a certain point.
Be right back.
Okay, welcome everybody. This is the Mises Academy class on drug prohibition. It's lecture 7. The overall class is Principles of Economics, and this is the spring 2012 edition of that class, and it's May 30th, 2012 right now. So tonight, we're going to be talking about drug prohibition. So this is one of my favorite topics in this course, because I think when it comes to I mean, if you just step back and you say, okay, well, first of all, how did I decide what topics to put into the textbook Lessons for the Young Economist? And then of that group, which survived the cut to make the first session of this class, this online class, which used to be 10 weeks, and then things evolved over time, and we thought we hit a sweet spot where an 8-week class is what most people preferred, just because of the, you know, the time commitments and so forth, and be able to keep the price down. And again, this lecture survived even that cut. So why do I think this is so important? Well, because, I mean, this really, in terms of the political philosophy of libertarianism, I think drug prohibition is really a defining issue, like, if you want to say, litmus test, because, you know, like, another obvious one would be something like the military draft, but nowadays that's not so decisive, or that doesn't really separate the libertarians from everybody else too much, because not many people nowadays support the military draft. All right, a lot of people supported it back when the U.S. had a military draft, ironically enough, when the government had a policy in place, most Americans thought, oh yeah, that makes sense. And now that the government doesn't do it, most Americans, I think, would say, oh yeah, it would be kind of weird to immoral to force people to go fight in a war against their will. But with drug prohibition, I think that's really the issue where it comes down to this clash between the sort of libertarian view of the world that just because you think certain bad social things are going to happen, you can't just systematically violate other people's property rights. And if somebody wants to do something that you think is immoral and dumb, but that it clearly is not violating anybody else's property rights, and the person's really just hurting himself, then in terms of property boundaries, then, you know, the standard libertarian position is you can't use government force to prevent that. And so I think that's why drug prohibition is an interesting issue from a political philosophy point of view, but that's obviously not what we're talking about in this course. In this course, we're going to go over the economics, and so again, that's why I'm focusing on it, and I really wanted to make sure it was in the textbook. Just to say one other thing before we get into the actual content of tonight's lecture, I mean, I really struggled with this particular chapter and debated, do we want to put this in here or not? Because as you'll notice, if you've gone through and read the textbook, and especially if you're a supporter of the Mises Institute, if you go to Mises.org and you've read a lot of Austrian stuff, or you read LouRockwell.com, that kind of thing, you'll notice that Lessons for the Young Economist is pretty sort of big tent, if you will. All right, that it's not that it's watered down, it's not that I diluted anything or I said something I didn't believe, but I tried to make statements and to give trains of argument that even non-Austrian, non-hardcore Murray Rothbard type libertarians would at least find compelling, whether or not they ended up agreeing with all the conclusions. All right, so I didn't want it to be a textbook on Austrian economics. I wanted it to simply be an introduction to free market economics to the, you know, to the young student. That's what the book was supposed to be. And so we knew when, you know, the Mises Institute commissioned me to do this, we knew that a primary market for that sort of book would be homeschooling parents. And that's, you know, in many respects, I wrote the book for them or for their students. And because of that, just again looking at the demographics and acknowledging reality, I knew there'd be a lot of religious people who would consider adopting this textbook and that they would love most of the worldview behind it, you know, talking about the importance of philosophy, talking about the importance of saving, being very skeptical of inflation, you know, real traditional conservative salt of the earth type values. But then I thought, you know, geez, do we want to talk about drug prohibition? Because, you know, that's something where a lot of religious homeschooling families are probably going to have strong views on, and that might be a deal breaker. But I decided that no, I really need to include this, because this really is, let me put it this way, when I think of the devastation that the U.S. federal government causes on Americans, I think the drug war is worse than even the income tax. all right, that obviously I personally, living in my comfortable upper middle class world, am more affected by the income tax than the drug war. You know, there's no danger that a SWAT team's going to come into my house and shoot me in the middle of the night because they got the address wrong and thought I was a drug dealer. That's not going to happen, whereas I lose a lot of my money every year to the IRS. But in terms of just the devastation and harm that the U.S. government rains down on Americans in general, I think the drug war is worse than the income tax, and we'll go over some of the stuff tonight. That, you know, the harms that it imposes on these specific communities, I think, you know, if you're going to be able to quantify that somehow, is worse than even the income tax. So in other words, if I could just change one major thing about U.S. federal policy to make things better for the average American, I would get rid of the drug war before I would get rid of the income tax. And it's not because I think the income tax isn't a big deal. It's because I think the drug war is absolutely devastating, and it drives so much else. I mean, for one thing, to show the connection between those two things I just mentioned, the pretext for the government monitoring your bank accounts, and if you're trying to fly out of the country, and then, you know, customs agents being able to open up your bags and being suspicious if you have a lot of cash, that kind of stuff, originally was because of the drug war. Now it's switched, and now they say, oh, because we're afraid you're funding terrorism. Okay, but my point is the drug war has been the pretext by which the federal government not only locks up millions of people, but also invades all sorts of your financial privacy, citing, you know, the war on drugs. So anyway, I think it's a really big issue, and that's why, since I think just standard economics can show, look at how all of these problems that the average American thinks is caused by drugs, and it's actually, no, it's caused by the drug war. All right, so that's why I thought it was really important to stress this stuff. George Smith asks in the comments, anything worse than drug prohibition? I think the U.S. military's foreign stuff is even a bigger deal than that. So, I mean, if there was one thing in terms of federal policy I could change overall, it would be to have a far less aggressive foreign policy. But I, you know, earlier I was framing it and saying which policies impact Americans the most. And I think that the drug war is, I mean, just think about what I just said. I'm being very consistent. I think when the U.S. government goes to war against some group, that's the worst thing it can do in terms of causing harm. And so you say, well, what would you change so the U.S. government's not hurting Americans? Well, right now the U.S. federal government is waging a war against Americans. They happen to be drug dealers and drug users, but they all are Americans, and the federal government has literally said that it's waging war against them. It hasn't formally declared the war, but hey, they haven't formally declared war in decades anyway. So, okay, George Smith asked me about the Fed. Depends which day of the week you catch me. Don't get me wrong, the Fed's really bad, but right now you're asking me get rid of the Fed or get rid of the drug war. I think I'd get rid of the drug war, even though I personally would benefit more from getting rid of the Fed. But I think some of the most vulnerable Americans, let me put it that way, really have their lives ruined by the drug war. And there's plenty of people who at a young age are thrown into prison where all sorts of horrible things happen to them. And, you know, not to say they didn't make bad decisions or that they didn't do things that would be considered sins from my religious perspective, but just what ends up happening to them is entirely unnecessary. Okay, so I've already anticipated some of this, but let's start making some disclaimers. Okay, there is a distinction, and everybody knows this, but it's important to go over it before we dive into tonight's lecture. There's a distinction between something being immoral versus being illegal. All right, so on this slide here, I've got a picture of Bill Clinton and, what's that actress's name? I'm drawing a blank. Somebody in the comments help me out. It's an actress. She gets caught shoplifting a lot. Winona Ryder, gee, okay. It's hard when you're trying to make cultural references and you forget what the reference is to. Okay, so Bill Clinton, I mean, he, I think, committed many crimes also, but I'm talking about the stuff with Monica Lewinsky. You know, that was very immoral, I would say. You know, I think cheating on your wife is one of the worst things you can do in terms of, you know, your everyday activities. But technically, that wasn't a crime, and I don't think it should be a crime, right? If somebody said, oh my gosh, don't you think we should put Bill Clinton in jail because he was unfaithful to his wife, I would say no. That would be a horrible policy. If the government literally criminally prosecuted people for cheating on their wives or their husbands, all right? On the other hand, what Winona Ryder was doing, you know, engaging in petty shoplifting when she could easily pay for the stuff she was taking, that technically is a crime. And although, you know, we can argue about should a monopoly government be in charge of enforcing laws or should there be Rothbardian defense agencies and so forth, I mean, if something is going to be considered a crime and punishable by a court system, clearly stealing another person's property, especially from like a store, clearly that's gonna count. That's gonna fall under that umbrella, right? But in the grand scheme of things, I think Bill Clinton cheating on his wife was a more serious offense, you know, to God. I mean, I happen to believe in God or whatever you want to say. You're against a moral code if you're an atheist, but you believe in some sort of rationally constructed moral code or whatever. I think what Bill Clinton did was worse than what Winona Ryder did. But again, that doesn't therefore mean the one activity should be more heavily punished by the government versus the other one, right? So again, in this lecture, it's going to be crystal clear what my own views are, and that I don't think the government should be prosecuting drug dealers. I don't think the government should be locking people up because they use heroin or cocaine. That's not because I think, oh, those are harmless activities, but rather it's because I don't think, you know, first of all, on any sort of political philosophy, or I should say philosophical grounded in a view of political theory, I don't see how you come up with that, where you think it's the proper scope of government to be punishing people for putting stuff into their bodies that you think is bad for them. That if you accept that premise, you can do all sorts of stuff that I think most of us would recoil from, saying that no, the government shouldn't be doing that, right? Like most people would give you another example. I think it's very harmful if people spend a lot of time reading Nazi propaganda, right? I think that would, or reading books put out by really extreme environmentalists who advocate coming up and genetically engineering viruses to kill humans in order to, you know, reduce the population by a few billion to stop harming the earth. Right, there are people out there who believe that and who put literature out, you know, advocating that kind of stuff. So I think that that's extremely harmful if more and more people start reading that kind of literature, but I don't think it should be a crime to read it. All right, whereas I do think it should be a crime to go into a store and steal a pack of chewing gum. Okay, so again, I'm just making this distinction to show that these things do not necessarily overlap. Like, murder is a case where they do overlap. Murder is a horrible thing to do to someone. It's a serious sin. It's a serious offense under any person's normal moral code, and it's also a crime, and I think it should be a crime, and that whatever institution in society is going to punish lawbreakers, they should be going after murderers if they're going after anybody. Okay, so there's one case where the two things do overlap, but in general, they need not overlap. So again, and I stress this because there are a lot of libertarians who celebrate drug use and think that not only should the government legalize it, but that we should, you know, think it's cool and whatever. I'll just stop that train of argument. So I'm saying I don't go down that path. You know, if I catch my son using marijuana or especially harder drugs when he's in seventh grade, he's going to be in trouble. But my point is, I don't think the government should have anything to do with that. It should be, you know, his parents having a talk with him and saying, you know, what are you doing, and coming up with family responses to that behavior. Okay. Another thing, framing the options here. What do I mean by this slide? What I'm trying to get across is, and this is what happens a lot when you have the issue of drug prohibition come up and then people debate it, the issue is not, would world be better without heroin? Okay? That's not the issue. All right? But a lot of times people who are in favor of drug prohibition act like that is the issue. You know, when you're saying to them, well, you know, why are you in favor of drug prohibition? They'll say things like, oh, well, look at last year, how many, you know, babies were born prematurely and died because, you know, their mother was using cocaine or, you know, or crack. You know, they call them crack babies. That was a big deal when I was growing up. I don't know if that trend has gone away or just people don't talk about it anymore. You know, so, or for people to say, you know, just looking at a heroin addict and saying, look at that guy, used to have a good job, his family depended on him, and then he tried heroin at a party or something and then got hooked and then everything fell apart and that's all he cared about, and just look at that, and now he just goes around begging and, you know, holding up convenience stores to get his next fix, and he doesn't know where his family is, they haven't heard from him in 6 months, and it's just, you know, look at the guy, just threw his life away, and it's the fault of heroin, and that's disgusting, and I can't even believe we're having this conversation. Of course this stuff should be illegal. Okay, so again, the issue there, I want to say, hang on, by you pointing to how awful that was, what you've just shown me is that, gee, it would be good if heroin had never existed, that whatever rush people get from using it is far more, or, you know, counterbalanced by, is overwhelmed by all of the bad things flowing from heroin use. That may be perfectly true, and I'm sure many religious people would agree with that. But what I'm saying is that's not the issue. The government does not have the power to get rid of heroin use. What we're really doing here is we're saying, do we want to have a policy where, you know, do we want the government to put heroin dealers in dungeons? I mean, that's really the issue. That's what we're talking about. Given the world the way it is right now, given the preferences people have, both on the consumer side and on the producer side, no matter what the government does, some people are going to, manufacture and distribute heroin, and other people are going to use it. That's not the issue. The issue is, do you think, do you want to live in a society where those people are allowed to do that by the government, and then, what sort of consequences are going to flow from that policy versus another policy where the government catches some of those people and puts them in prison and punishes them? All right, so to say I don't like people using heroin, that's not the end of the story. People are going to use heroin both ways and under both scenarios. And so the issue really is, look at what's actually going to happen. This is really just another way of saying, as an economist, you have to think on the margin, right? Because, again, it's not that you're choosing between a world with heroin use and a world without heroin use. The government does not have the power to give us that choice. You have to look at the world under drug prohibition and without drug prohibition. I mean, what's funny is, people talking about how bad heroin use are pointing to examples of people who are addicted to heroin right now when it's heavily prohibited. You see the irony there? I mean, really what you should do, if you wanted to be coherent, is you should point to how awful things were, the drug addiction and so forth, in the United States before heroin was regulated. But that's not what people do. They instead point to all these nightmare cases of people who get addicted to heroin, even though at the time it was illegal and their own policy was enforced. So it's a bit weird to point to failures that happen under their own policy regime to justify having those policies. All right, so me having pointed that out, that's not a decisive argument in and of itself. They could just come back and say, well, there'd be more of those nightmare scenarios if we didn't have it illegal. And so that's what we have to debate over. But that's what I'm saying in this slide about framing the options is, you know, once you bring that up, so okay, so now you're admitting the question is, you know, if you want to minimize drug addiction or something like that, then we have to go further and say, okay, give me an argument that your policy of drug prohibition reduces or is likely to reduce the number of heroin addicts, because I'm not convinced that that's even true. Clearly, there are plenty of heroin addicts right now, even with your policy. So show me that your policy is making that number lower than it would be under a free market, if you will, in heroin or whatever the drug is that we're talking about. Okay, next slide, what I'm calling focusing on the negative. What do I mean by this? That for sake of brevity, I'm focusing on the downside of drug prohibition. Okay, so what I mean by this is that if I were trying to be sort of a neutral moderator and I were refereeing a debate between somebody on one side who was for drug prohibition and somebody on the other side who was against it, I would try to be more even-handed, and I would, every time the side that wanted to legalize currently prohibited drugs made an argument, you know, I would say, well, but, you know, the response to that would be, you get what I'm saying, or every time they brought up some statistics, I would try to clarify and say, well, you know, what would the statistics look like if you were wrong, and da-da-da-da-da. And I'm saying, both in the textbook chapter and here, I'm not even pretending to do that, because I think certainly people in the United States, I can't speak for other countries, but certainly anyone growing up in the United States has had it drilled into his or her head since childhood about how awful drugs are, and that's why they're illegal, because they're just such an awful thing. So I think everybody has already heard plenty from the side saying this is why drugs should be illegal. And this is why we lock up those bad drug dealers, and has seen all sorts of movies and stuff showing how bad these people are. And, you know, you've been inculcated to think, well, it's only natural then that the government should crack down on them. And it's keeping us safe. It's keeping drugs away from our kids. And so because of that, what I think is a propaganda campaign that all Americans have experienced since childhood, in the interest of brevity, I'm just going to here sort of give the other side. So I'm just acknowledging that up front, that here this is not a fair and balanced and neutral treatment. I'm giving specific reasons that bolster the position saying that the drug war should be ended. Okay, one main point in this is the issue of corruption. And here I really think, I mean, I can remember when I was younger, and I called myself a conservative, and I listened to Rush Limbaugh, and I read National Review and stuff like that, and I can just think back, and I remember my worldview at the time, and I used to be for drug prohibition. You know, I'm talking like when I was in, well, junior high for sure, high by high school, I'd become libertarian, I'm not sure at what point I switched, but in terms of my views toward drug prohibition. But at one point in my life, I remember I was really hardcore, you know, that I thought, you know, and I would say things like, I'd have arguments with people, and my aunt would say, you know, oh, well, you know, shouldn't we have compassion? And she meant, like, compassion for people who made some bad decisions in their lives, and they ended up addicted to drugs, and shouldn't we have compassion for them? And I remember saying to her something like, no, I have compassion for the crack babies. You know, it's like, that's who I care about. They're the innocent victims in this, not the drug dealers and not the drug users. You know, they knew what they were doing. Yeah, so I was just, I can remember being real dogmatic about that. So anyway, now that I see things, and to me it's so obvious the drug war is a failure on any number of dimensions, you know, moral, practical, social, what have you. What I think, and I'm trying to just remember, like think back and say, what was, how could I have been so wrong from my current standpoint back then when I used to think that? And one of the big things was that I had no idea about the level of police corruption that exists. And I, again, here's an issue where I think people living in other countries might not be as naive, but you foreigners would probably be shocked if they knew the average American's view of the police. And this has gotten, I think the average American has become more informed over time. But I mean, I remember thinking that, you know, the very idea that the police would systematically accept bribes from drug dealers was just, that would have been inconceivable to me when I was in seventh grade. You know, I might have known that there was one bad police officer out of 10,000 or something, but I mean, just like there's, you know, a bad guy anywhere, but the idea that the police would systematically take bribes from drug dealers would have been inconceivable to me. And so that's the thing you need to realize, is that the drug trade is only possible because the police allow it. And I guess what I mean by that is like the large scale drug trade. Okay? So here, what I don't mean is that, oh, gee, if we just had different police officers in there, all drug use would be stamped out. That's not what I'm saying, but what I mean is the current large-scale drug trafficking operations that occur would not be possible if there wasn't a whole network in place where police are systematically paid off, judges are on the payroll of drug dealers, and so forth. Okay, and it's, if you're not, if you're new to that sort of claim, if that raises your eyebrow and you're, I've never really thought about that. That seems like a pretty strong claim there, Dr. Murphy. Are you sure? I would strongly recommend you watch this movie that I've listed over here, Al Pacino and Serpico. Okay, so if you're being homeschooled and you're a young child, you know, your parents will have to be the arbiters if you're allowed to watch that movie. I think it's an R-rated movie, mostly for violence, I believe, and maybe some bad language. So parents, be on the alert. You vet that thing before you let your third grade student watch it. But it's a true story. It's based on a true story of this narcotics officer in the New York police force, Frank Serpico, played by Al Pacino in this movie. And, I mean, it's really just incredible. And it lines up with, I mean, I've read plenty of true crime stuff and read, you know, things. So not just fictional things, but, you know, actual discussions of things from various sources over the years. And, I mean, this isn't some isolated deal, that especially in large cities, the narcotics officers are routinely paid off by drug dealers, right? So it's not even that, you know, if the cop's walking down the street and he sees some guy selling a bag of something to somebody, that then on the spot he says, okay, I can take you in or you can give me $20. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm saying they have systematic, prearranged cuts that they get from the business where, you know, the bag man will, you know, the certain drug gang will be selling various types of drugs in their area, will make a certain amount of money, and then they just know we have a deal with the cops where we give, you know, we deliver $100,000 every other Tuesday to this police officer, you know, at this particular street corner at 8 o'clock in the morning. And they're expecting that $100,000 payment from us, and if we're short, or if we just stop making it, well, then they'll just arrest us because they know we're breaking laws and they can pull, take us in at any time. But they choose not to because we've cut a deal with them and we're giving that flow of revenue. And so, like I say, it's not some haphazard thing. It is a, like a contractual arrangement. I'm not saying they literally signed a contract, but it's an arrangement they come to, and there are regular systematic payoffs to various people, and there are certain judges that are on the payroll of drug dealers, and so that when, you know, whenever a legal issue comes up, those, you know, those people know that that judge is on our side, and they'll make sure nothing ever happens, nothing ever sticks to us in court. Now, what they do, so one way to understand it is that the government enforces a drug cartel. Right. So it's not that the government turns a blind eye to all drug trafficking. No, if it catches people that aren't paying it off, those people are going to jail. It's going to prosecute them. But the point is this, the ones that are paying off the government and that they've come to an arrangement with, those people don't get touched. And so, so again, one way to view that is that the government is enforcing a drug cartel, that there are certain privileged producers, certain drug dealers, drug traffickers, who effectively have the state apparatus backing up their business and knocking out competitors. You know, a certain drug gang that's in with the local narcotics division of the police department in a big city knows that its people can go around, you know, so long, you know, there might be parameters on what they're allowed to do. You know, maybe they can only sell on certain neighborhoods or whatever, and they're supposed to stay away from schools. Who knows what the parameters are, but as long as they don't mess with the rules the cops lay down, their guys aren't getting arrested. You know, even if neighbors call up and say, hey, there's these drug dealers hanging out in the street corner, get rid of them, you know, the police might come up and say, guys, you got to, you know, we got complaints, you got to get out of here for now. But they're not going to take them and throw them in jail for 30 years, even though they could, according to the laws and the books. All right. Whereas some other rival gang comes up that doesn't have an agreement with the cops and isn't giving them a dime, and they're selling drugs across the corner from that first group, the first group's going to call up the cops and say, hey, these guys are stealing our business, and the cops will come and lock those guys up and put them in jail. All right, so it's enforcing a cartel, propping up certain privileged producers, allowing them to sell the products at a higher price than would otherwise be the case. It's just a standard analysis of how a cartel works. But again, it's like the drug gang gets all the cops with all their guns to do its work for them. But the drug gang would never be able to enforce such a rigid control of the market, because it's expensive to have thousands of people with guns knocking out competitors and putting them in, you know, the drug gang couldn't afford to do that, to mount that sort of offensive strike against potential competitors who want to come in and enter the market and push down the price of whatever they're selling. But they get the government to do it for them. And they have to pay the government. They share the profits. So that's one way of analyzing what happens with the drug war in practice. Okay, so it's interesting. Let's push this further and say, well, why is there this connection? And again, it's I should have backed up. Let me say one more thing. I've got this other picture here of Blagojevich, you can never say that guy's name, the, you know, discredited guy from Illinois. Chicago is routinely considered one of the most corrupt cities in the world, certainly in the United States, in terms of the government officials there. And I think I put it in the textbook. I mean, the stuff that the Chicago Police Department has gotten caught doing in terms of with drug dealers, I mean, it's amazing. Like, I think there have been DEA stings of the Chicago Police Department. So in other words, the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency has had to, you know, conduct operations against Chicago police officers because it was just so outrageous that, you know, they're like, guys, you're just, you know, you can't do this. I mean, things like drug dealers would bring cocaine into Chicago, you know, on a private plane, and then would get out. And so if you're thinking about it, you know, that's kind of risky, right? You're importing large amounts of cocaine from Mexico, let's say. You know, maybe it was produced in South America and it comes up through various channels and then it's in Mexico. And then the question is, how are we going to get to the U.S.? So they're paying off, you know, certain border inspectors or whatever, whoever it is at the Mexican airport, customs and whatever, that's supposed to prevent stuff from getting in. Those people are getting paid off, so they let it go through. And then it lands at Chicago. People at the Chicago airport that normally customs, whatever, should be stopping that, they're getting paid off. They let it go through. But then if you think about it, you know, lots of people know about this, and that's a very valuable product, right? I mean, if you were flying in bags full of rubies or emeralds, you'd want to have big armored trucks there waiting for you. But this is illegal cocaine, so you got to be, you know, you can't be too blatant about it, but yet you want protection. So what do? You're going to hire, you know, four guys with guns? Well, no, because what are four guys with guns going to do? You really want somebody that's intimidating that nobody's going to mess with. So what do? They hire off-duty police officers to drive them around, right? So, again, there were Chicago, you know, people literally in the Chicago police force who, when they're not working, or maybe they even were working, I don't know if they're off-duty, you know, they would go and the drug smugglers would land in their private plane, come out, they take the cocaine, get into a car, and be driven around to wherever they needed to go through the streets of Chicago by Chicago police officers. Because if you think about it, that's the safest way to move your drugs around. You know the cops aren't going to mess with you because the cops are driving the car, and you know criminals are less likely to try to steal your stuff because they know you get in big trouble if you take the cops on head on. I mean, you're pretty much got to leave the city at that point. Okay. Whereas if it were just driven by four thugs with AK-47s that you hired, some other crazy group might just try to shoot everybody and take the drugs. But they're not going to want to shoot two cops in the car because then, you know, all hell is going to come down on them from the Chicago Police Department because they killed two cops. Right. So that's how that stuff works. So, again, when I say there's corruption here, if you're not aware of that, I mean, it's, again, it's not, oh, they saw someone on the street corner selling some marijuana and they took a $20 bill to keep walking. No, it is systematic payoffs, police driving around drug dealers and helping them deliver the stuff because the people realize police officers are the best protection you can buy. All right, so really crazy stuff. So now the question is, why does that happen? How is it even possible? And how come we see it so much with illegal narcotics and we don't see it so much in other areas? So that's what I'm going to try to do here, and I'm going to use economics to try to explain that. But again, the fact that this is a pattern that exists is undeniable to anyone who starts looking into this. The question is just, why is this happening? And that's where I think economics can help shed light on it. Okay, so let me just look at the textbook here and make something that's consistent with it. So what I'm going to show you here is the market for cocaine. All right, so we have an initial supply and demand curve. So suppose the government didn't have anything special to do about cocaine. I mean, maybe there'd be sales taxes or whatever, but cocaine was treated just like aspirin as far as the government was concerned. So you have supply and demand. And, you know, who knows how much it would be. Let's say it would be $1 for a certain weight, and that at that there'd be 1 million grams sold. All right. I just keep glancing over the textbook to make sure I'm making it consistent. Okay, so now the question is, what if the government comes in to this market and says, okay, you know what, if we catch you with a bunch of cocaine on you, you're going to get in trouble. If you have enough cocaine that we think you're a user, you're going to get, well, you know, first probably you'll just get a warning and get, you know, sentenced to drug rehab or something, and we'll put your name in the paper and you'll be really embarrassed, and if you're a high school principal, you're going to lose your job, that kind of stuff, but you're probably not going to do prison time. If we catch you a second time and we just think you're using it, then you're probably going to go to prison for 6 months and then another rehab and da da da, and, you know, we'll keep escalating the punishments. But if we catch you with so much cocaine in your possession that we're sure you're a dealer, you're a cocaine dealer, you could get anywhere from 20 to 50 years in prison. So your life is effectively over if you get convicted of being a cocaine dealer. So that's the set of incentives that the government now imposes on the cocaine market relative to this initial equilibrium that's a free market where, you know, a unit of cocaine sells for $1 and people buy 1 million grams. All right, so what happens? Well, again, this is just like, you know, analyzing price control or analyzing the minimum minimum wage or rent control. You just have to ask, okay, given the new policy, what is it going to do, if anything, to the supply and demand curves? Okay, it will reduce demand. And so other things equal, people are now going to be less willing to buy units of cocaine at various hypothetical prices, because now they know if I get caught with this stuff, I'm going to jail. And there's other things too that, if we, you know, took the analysis further, that the product purity is going to go down and stuff like that, that, you know, now you have to drive to a seedy area where there's dangerous criminals who might be selling you the cocaine. So there's various reasons that it's less attractive for most people to buy as much cocaine as they otherwise would have. For many people, it's going to be zero no matter what. But for the people that might be buying it a lot, if it's legal, they're going to be less willing to buy it. It's at various prices, or they're going to buy less of it at various hypothetical prices. Okay, so the demand would go down, other things equal. So we'll do that. We'll put the demand down. Okay. So D1 goes to D2. Now what about the supply? Well, the supply is going to go down as well, because now people know, before, you know, there were major pharmaceutical companies who were selling cocaine, just like they were selling aspirin. And now they learn, oh, by the way, if we catch you selling cocaine, your life's over. You're going to go to prison for 50 years. So is that going to affect people's willingness to sell various amounts of cocaine at certain prices? Of course it is. It's going to drastically affect it. So the supply curve is going to go down. And what I'm saying is the supply is going to be affected much more than the demand. So I'll draw the supply. Curve like that. All right, so the point is now that at the new equilibrium where S2 intersects D2, the price has gone way up, and so I just said in the textbook maybe it went up to $100. All right, and that's not an exaggeration. I've seen, I mean, who knows how accurate these things are. It's hard to assess. But I've seen estimates saying that, and I believe these estimates were coming from supporters of the drug war. So to cite the effectiveness of their policies, of their campaign, I've seen estimates saying that the street price of cocaine is up to 1,000 times higher because of the drug war than it would be, you know, if there were no government prohibitions on it. All right, so again, in terms of the basic supply-demand analysis, you would say, yeah, it reduces demand, but it greatly restricts the supply so that the equilibrium price ends up going through the roof. So why is that important? Well, we're trying to understand how is it that there can be such police corruption when it comes to illegal narcotics. And so I'm going to say one huge component of that explanation, or one big piece of that story, is that drug prohibition makes the market value of drugs get really high. So notice what happens there is Well, I'll come back to that point in a minute. All right. We'll talk more in a few slides about exactly what happens there with the price going up. Okay, but for right now, I still want to talk about this issue of corruption and how is it that there can be such rampant corruption, you know, with many, many police officers involved, many judges and so forth. And I think another main part of the story to get people to understand how this can happen is that what's somewhat euphemistically referred to as victimless crimes as compared to crimes that have actual specific victims. All right, now there's a sense in which, so in case people don't know the term, so victimless crime, what people mean when they talk about that are things like drugs, prostitution, loan sharking, and gambling. Okay, so in many areas, many jurisdictions, these things are illegal or heavily regulated to some extent. Okay, loan sharking, if you don't know what that term means, that means giving a short-term loan at a very high interest rate. All right, so that's the kind of thing that the mafia might do. Right? Like if you need to borrow money and a bank won't give it to you, and you really need the money, you can go to the mafia, and they'll give it to you, but they might charge you whatever 20% interest per week, and if you miss the interest payment, they break your kneecaps. Okay, so that's illegal. I mean, breaking your kneecaps is illegal, but charging 20% interest is illegal also, right? And there's various regulations on how much you're allowed to charge. Okay, so, and then you guys all know what the other things are. So people will say that those things like drugs, prostitution, loan sharking, and gambling are victimless crimes because if you're looking at the transaction itself, both sides are there voluntarily, right? When the drugs, there, and that's what I'm showing here in the slide, there is a big difference just psychologically between this picture and this picture. Okay, clearly on the right, somebody is a victim. That guy is there, they're robbing him, it looks like, against his will. Whereas on the left, you know, we might object to that, and we might say, oh, you're throwing your life away, or gee, you've got a little kid at home who's depending on you to keep your job, and so that kid is being victimized by you using drugs. But in terms of the transaction itself, there's a sense in which that thing on the left isn't hurting anybody the same way that the activity on the right is clearly hurting someone. You can see him right there. He's getting hurt. All right. So what I'm saying is that whether one finds that terminology compelling or not, you know, that, and I've seen plenty of people in these arguments over drug legalization dismiss this term. And they say, oh, come on, there's no such, you know, it's not true that drug use is victimless. Because there's plenty, you know, they'll talk about divorce and, you know, guys beating their wives because they're alcoholics and on drugs and all that kind of stuff. But, like I say, what I'm trying to show you here is you can see why corruption is more closely connected with these so-called victimless crimes, whether or not you like the term victimless crime. Because if you're a police officer or you're a judge or you're somebody who works at customs in an airport or you're working border security, letting trucks go through, you know, think of it for that. You're a guy working on the Mexican border. You know, you're working for the U.S. government. And your job is to prevent trucks going into the U.S. that have contraband on it. So, you know, you can understand it's much more believable, it's much more plausible that somebody with that job would look the other way and take bribes to allow people to ship in cocaine. Whereas if some, you know, Islamic fundamentalist came up and said, hey, I've got a bunch of explosives and I'm going to go kill 1,000 Americans with these bombs, but I'm going to pay you $10,000 if you let me through, they're not going to let the guy through, right? Whereas if he says, I'll give you $10,000 because there's a bunch of Americans who really like my product and I'm just going to give it to them, and they're going to be happy, and they're going to give me money for it, and that's, and you're not going to hear anything else about it, you can see why the guy would say, gee, you're going to give me how much? You're going to give me $10,000? Okay. And that's what I'm saying here, that there's a bit, I think, psychologically, to understand how could this corruption be so rampant, it's partly because these are, for lack of a better term, victimless crimes. Okay, so what I'm trying to get you to see here, or I'm trying to deal with an objection that a lot of times when these debates come up and people will say, oh, look at the police corruption. And, you know, we should legalize these drugs so that, you know, because the police don't enforce the laws as it is. And it's real selective enforcement, and it makes a mockery of the rule of law, and it breeds disrespect for the court system and blah, 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 blah. And so what a typical response will be is to say, well, gee whiz. I mean, so I guess if the mafia starts paying off the police when they go kill somebody, you know, they have contract hits, that you think we should legalize murder then, because, you know, there's corruption there too. And what I'm saying is it's not even in the same ballpark. When you want to say, you know, when you talk about corruption and how the government's getting paid off, it is because of these commercial activities. And that's one way to think about it. These are businesses, all right? So it's true, organized crime gets involved in these areas, but only because they're prohibited. That's what the connection is. It's not that these things are inherently icky and sinful and odious, and so that's why organized criminals are attracted to them. No, the reason organized criminals are attracted to these things is because they are businesses, so there's a lot of money to be made, and then when the government makes it illegal, then it makes that area very attractive to organized crime figures. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later in the lecture. All right, so when you're trying to understand then, okay, you know, what's the connection between illegal drugs and massive systematic payoffs to government officials who are supposed to be stopping this activity? So the one point that we already went over was the huge price increases that the drug war causes. So now there's a lot of money available to offer as bribes. You know, so the aspirin manufacturers or the drug stores that sell aspirin, the government came around to them and said, hey, we expect you to pay us $10,000 every other Tuesday. They would say, well, we don't have it. You know, there's a very low margin when it comes to selling aspirin. If the choice is between giving you $10,000 every other Tuesday or just not selling aspirin anymore, I guess I'm going to not sell aspirin because there's no margin, whereas there's a huge margin with illegal drugs, so they can afford to make these payoffs. And then now the point I'm making with this slide is, and then why do the police take these payments in order to systematically allow certain groups to sell drugs, to have prostitution rings, to have excessive interest rates when they make loans to people, and to run gambling operations? It's because those things really, in the grand scheme, don't seem as bad as if, you know, there were this group of people that were literally grabbing people and torturing them to death in a basement somewhere, right? I don't think police departments would be getting bag money from those guys, and also because that's not a business, right? You couldn't make millions of dollars grabbing people and torturing them to death. I mean, that's a horrible thing anyway, but the point is there's no money to be made in that, okay? Whereas there is plenty of money to be made bringing cocaine up from South America and then selling it to people in the United States. There's tons of money in that line of work, and so that's why it's an area that organized crime is drawn to and then can systematically pay off government officials. And since it's a victimless crime, that's why so many government employees are willing to go down that route, whereas I don't think they would, I don't think corruption would be so rampant if we were talking about homicide. Okay. Corruption, cause and consequence. What am I saying here? So let me do corruption over, oops, corruption, and over here, drug trafficking. So corruption, in one sense, is a cause of drug trafficking. And so what do I mean by that? That you need to have government corruption in order for drug trafficking to occur, if there's, you know, if it's illegal. And that's why I have this executioner guy. All right, so there are places, for example, Afghanistan, when the Taliban were in charge, where my understanding is they pretty much stamped out, you know, grow the poppies or whatever, and you know, use that in the drug trade. It was after the liberation, according to the U.S. terminology, of course, of Afghanistan, when the you know, U.S. forces went in and got rid of the Taliban and established a government more to the U.S.'s liking, then the drug trafficking returned to Afghanistan, right? Because the deal was, under the Taliban, they would, like, cut your hand off, and I guess they'd kill you or something if they really caught you being a drug dealer, because they were motivated for religious reasons, and they wouldn't take a bribe, whereas, you know, the people put in place by the U.S. or the U.S. officials themselves were not as, you know, they weren't religious zealots, and so to them, you know, it wasn't an unspeakable outrage to see someone dealing drugs. That was just like, oh, well, you want to do that, you know, it's going to cost you. All right, so what I'm saying then is that you need to have government corruption in a society where there are stiff penalties against drug dealing. You need to have corruption in order for it to be widespread. All right, there has to be the police routinely looking the other way and the, you know, judicial system not convicting certain people in order for the thing to flourish. Otherwise, it would happen. One good example of this is in actual prison. The prisoners use illegal drugs. Okay, so that's a lot of times a very good argument, I think, from the legalization camp, is they're going to say, we can't even keep illegal drugs out of the hands of federal prisoners. So how the heck do you think you're going to keep it out of the homes of average Americans? All right, and so you say, what do you mean you can't? How does it get in the prisons? Well, because the guards bring it in, right? There are certain guards that have deals with various inmates, and they, I don't know how it works. I don't know how the inmates pay them. Maybe they have people on the outside pay them, but they bring in drugs and, you know, give them to certain people on the inside, and then maybe they distribute. I don't know how it works, but the point is, you know, if they do random drug testing and stuff of people who are inmates in federal prison, they will detect that some of them are using illegal drugs even though they've been locked up for 10 years. So how are they getting it? Well, it has to be because of the prison staff. And so the point is, you know, clearly that would not be possible if the Taliban were running that prison, or if a bunch of, you know, evangelical Christians who are really hardcore were running that prison, and, you know, it would just be inconceivable to them that they would, you know, bring in cocaine and give it to convicted murderers or something. Like, that would just be an unspeakable sin in their mind. Okay, but in reality, in the real world, the sorts of people that end up working in federal prisons, there are enough of them willing to do it. And also, the superiors, you know, their managers and upper level management and so forth, it's not a burning priority in their mind to stamp that out. Because that's the other thing, too. It's not just an issue of finding the weakest link in the chain and finding some random guard, you know, who maybe has gambling debts or something and he needs money. And so then in desperation, he says, oh, well, you know, these drug dealers on the outside, so they pay me $5,000 a month if I would just smuggle this stuff in, so maybe I'll do it. it needs to be more than that. There also has to be, in order for it to happen, the people who run the prison, I mean, if they wanted to stamp it out, they know as much as anybody else the temptations that are going to affect their employees. So they could just have, you know, like when you come into work, if you're a guard, you go through some kind of process to make sure you're not smuggling drugs in. But they obviously don't do that, right? Because it's not high on their list of priorities to stamp that out, either because they don't care or because they're getting a cut of the money too. Who knows? So that's my point, is that in order for, you know, the government has plenty of legal authority and plenty of resources that it could lock up a lot more people than it actually does. So it's a little bit ironic. Part of what I'm saying here is the government doesn't actually enforce the existing drug laws with the vehemence or the vigilance that it could legally. And so that sort of, you know, so that's the sense in which government corruption is a cause of drug trafficking, that it's a necessary condition. And on the other hand, though, it's a consequence of it too. That, you know, the corruption is a consequence of the drug trafficking, that, let me put it this way. If you had a system where drugs had never been illegal, and that system had been in place for 50 years, and then you come in and you randomly somehow survey and figure out what percentage of judges and which percentage of police officers and so forth, customs agents, whatever, you know, what percentage of them are corrupt in the sense that they're receiving payments from private citizens to not perform their job duties the way they're supposed to, I think the percentage is going to be far lower than in a system where drugs are illegal. And that's because I think the temptations are there. When you make drugs illegal, now all of a sudden there's this very lucrative business with billions of dollars flowing through it every year. And that's available now for to be used to pay off government officials. All right, so once you have that in place, then that sets in motion its own dynamic. And that's why I highly recommend that movie, Serpico. I sort of left you guys hanging. What that movie's about, this guy Frank Serpico was actually an honest cop. That he ended up working in the, you know, narcotics division or whatever for the NYPD, and he didn't want to take money from drug dealers. And so the movie shows what happened to him. And just to give you a hint, it's not that the drug dealers were mad at him. It's that the other cops retaliated. So I don't want to spoil the movie. That's all I'll say. But the point is, that was the issue. So what I'm saying, the corruption sort of feeds on itself. Because if you're an honest person and you really want to enforce the law and you just want to, you know, help your community and get rid of these dirty drug dealers, if you start going through the ranks and you realize that in the drug enforcement part of the police agency, half the guys there, you know, are doing all sorts of stuff that you think are like, whoa, I can't believe you did that, you know, or like, oh my gosh, Jim over there, I heard last week that he escorted a drug dealer around in his cop car. Can you believe that? And not only that there are people doing outrageous things, but then everybody else is just not talking about it and is letting it happen. Well, then, you know, you're going to feel uncomfortable. Those people are going to feel uncomfortable around you. They're not going to trust you if you don't take drug dealer money, because they're going to be worried that you're, like, you know, working for the internal affairs and that you're, you know, telling them who the dirty cops are. So, I mean, it just doesn't work. So over time, what ends up happening is just the really corrupt people end up in those positions because the other people just don't even want to work around that environment. Okay, so that's the sense in which the drug trafficking and the availability of all this money to be used as bribes ends up corrupting the judicial and police services. All right, prohibition and violence. So here's something that you can use economics to understand. So again, the big picture, the just the correlation is undeniable. They clearly, I mean, and I think for a U.S. audience, the example of alcohol is just, I mean, it's open and shut. In the 1920s, and up and through, one of the few decent things FDR did was to get rid of alcohol prohibition. It was illegal to distribute alcohol, just like right now it's illegal to sell cocaine. And what happened? Well, then there were gangs, most famously Al Capone's gang, that were bootleggers. And so they would illegally distribute it because people still like to drink, just like people right now still like to smoke marijuana and use harder drugs. So there's still a market for it, and people were willing to break the law because there was a lot of money to be made. And how did they get away with doing that? Well, because they would systematically pay off the cops and the judges. And beyond all that, though, there was a lot of violence, a lot of gangland warfare. And they would have, you know, Tommy guns, and there was the St. Valentine's Day massacre when members of Capone's gang took out members of, I forget who it was. Was it Bugs somebody? Bugs Moreno, maybe, took out his gang, and that was a famous thing at the time because it was just shocking. You know, nowadays it wouldn't be a big deal, but back then that was a horrific example of gangland violence. And you certainly see it today, you know, with the drug warfare, particularly like in Mexico and Colombia and so forth, when there's, you know, there are rebel groups that are actually so powerful that the government can't, you know, the government kind of leaves them in their own area. And I think in the last few years, the governments may have gotten a little bit stronger relative to the drug lords. But the point is, I mean, these gangs, they're not just little gangs. I mean, they're systematic enterprises that have an international presence and can hold their own against major governments. So, back to alcohol, you know, you could say, well, gee, why is it that alcohol is like that? Is it just because it's you know, the devil's drink, and it's just, you know, look at how bad alcohol is? And well, no. Once they legalized it, the gangland violence disappeared. It would be inconceivable today if you open up your newspaper and the headline said, you know, the CEO of Coors was shot dead from a rival, you know, liquor company, something like that. Or, you know, one liquor store owner hired some guys to go blow up another liquor store so that he could capture market share. You would never even, that would be inconceivable. Whereas it's totally plausible. You open up the newspaper and it says one gang that dealt cocaine had a drive-by shooting and took out the members of another gang. That would be like, oh yeah, that happens all the time. And so my point is that the connection there has to do with the prohibition. And it's a clear-cut example with alcohol that when it was prohibited, the people selling it and distributing it shot each other, and when it's legal now, that would be inconceivable. And so, you know, all these armed gangs and so forth in American inner cities and all these really armed enterprises in Mexico and Colombia and so forth, I think they would largely disappear overnight if governments around the world completely legalized cocaine and heroin and so forth. So you could, you know, there could be other things that you'd say would happen. You know, maybe the number of people going to the hospital for drug overdoses would go up or whatever, but I think these gangs would collapse very quickly if the government just got rid of all this stuff, just like the mafia is no longer involved with selling beer, whereas it used to be. Okay, we have this historical correlation. It really does seem like there's something about drug prohibition that causes a gross escalation in the violence associated with that industry. So as economists, can we elaborate on that? Like what exactly is going on? Why is that? So again, the connection seems clear, but specifically what's going on. Okay, so I broke it up into two things. I said, first of all, it raises the marginal benefits of violence, and then I want to say it simultaneously lowers the marginal cost of violence. All right, so if I can convince you of those two things, if I can convince you that drug prohibition relative to an initial situation where we had laissez-faire, if the government now by introducing drug prohibition on certain key drugs, if you agree with me that it raises the marginal benefits to people in those areas who use violence, while it lowers the marginal cost, well then, as economists used to say, that which that should lead to more violence, because I've increased the benefit and I've lowered the cost. Okay, so how does it raise the marginal benefit? Well, remember that diagram that we drew before. So here was the initial supply and demand curve for cocaine. And initially it sold for a dollar, and there were a million grams. And then the demand goes down a little bit with prohibition, but the supply just gets devastated. So that here's the new equilibrium price. It's way up here, $100, let's say. And also the quantity goes way down too. I had to go down to 10,000. All right, so what do I mean about raising the marginal benefits of violence? Well, look at this increase here. What ends up happening is, so something that before would sell for a dollar now sells for $100. But it's not because the monetary expense of producing cocaine has gone up. Rather, the reason the price had to go up was because now the people who are the suppliers who are still staying in the industry, what they're doing is it's an effect that's like it's like hazard pay, right? They have to be compensated for the fact that they're taking a really big risk now. They know that if they're going to continue to sell cocaine, that there's a good chance they're going to get caught and convicted and then go to prison for a long time, right? So in order to make them willing to continue to do that, the financial rewards have to go up. All right, so it's, you know, in one sense, it's not that, how am I gonna put it? Whether there's prohibition or whether the market for cocaine is totally legal, you would say more and more suppliers will enter the market until on the margin there's no incentive for anyone else to enter. So that's a true statement. But what I'm saying is when it's legal, what happens is more and more people enter until the equilibrium price gets so low that now, you know, on the margin, there's not really much of a return. It's not worth spending the money to buy cocaine from, you know, producers in Colombia or whatever and ship it up and then put it on your store shelf and, you know, pay for the electricity and whatever to heat the building and to have a person at the cash register to sell the product. It's just all things considered for the low price that the consumer is going to pay for it, it's not worth it. And so, you know, you have an equilibrium. Whereas when it's illegal and the government's going to throw you in prison for 50 years if it catches you selling cocaine and you're not paying them off, then the price settles at whatever, $100. 100 times more. And so the rate of return on your financial investment is huge, right? It's not that it became all that much more expensive to get the stuff from Colombia, but now the point is you need to make much more money in your pocket when all is said and done in order for you to do it. And plenty of people don't do it. All right, so in the new equilibrium, why did the price settle at 100? How come it doesn't go down to 99, 98, 97? Because at 100, there are some people in the market selling it, and everybody else who's thinking about getting in says, nah, it's not worth it. Yeah, I could make $1 million a year if I did that full time, but that's not worth it to me. I'd rather make $80,000 a year being an accountant and not having to carry a gun with me and you know, worry at night that the police are going to raid me and whatever. I'd rather do that and have a normal life than make $1 million a year and be a flashy drug dealer, but no, I'm going to get shot by my rivals or I'm going to go to prison pretty soon. Okay, so that's the issue. So given that now in the prohibited market, that's the way things are, notice that the markup still on any particular unit is huge, right? You don't have to pay that much out of pocket to get a kilo of cocaine from your wholesaler. And then what you do, where you make your money, is you chop it up and you sell it in smaller bursts to other people, either to, you know, small-time dealers or if you sell directly to the end user. That's what you do. So you buy it wholesale at a fairly low price, and then you sell it retail, and you make a huge markup. And that's how you end up getting such a huge monetary income, out of which you have to pay off police, and you have to pay for guns, and you have to hire a bunch of thugs, and so forth, to make sure you don't get shot. Okay, so my point, though, is in that new market, where there's that huge markup, that huge rate of return, and just looking in terms of how much did you spend out of pocket to get the wholesale price or the wholesale product, and then how much can you turn around and sell it for, that markup is huge. And so given that you're already a drug dealer and you're already flying in cocaine from Colombia and paying wholesale for it and you already got a distribution network, you make a lot more on the margin from taking over one more street corner. Right? If you can move 10% more product per month, you might make an extra $100,000 a year without taking on that much more additional risk. Okay? Whereas if you're selling aspirin where the markup is very little, if you take over another street corner, you're not going to make 10% more in terms of your monetary profit. Okay, so what I'm saying is I'm trying to get you to see why drug dealers are so jealous of their turf and why they benefit from expanding their territory is because of that huge markup just on the monetary side of things, because really what they're getting paid for, compensated for, is the risk involved in being in that industry. And so it makes a big difference whether you have 1,000 customers or whether you have 1,200 customers. And it might be worth it to you to shoot somebody if he's got 200 customers and you think if he's dead and then everyone else is afraid to enter the market because they just saw I killed him and now I'm going to get those 200 customers. That might need an extra $100,000 a year. So would you kill a guy for $100,000? Sure. But the aspirin dealer, he says, oh, should I kill the other guy selling aspirin across the street? He's going to make an extra $2,000 a year if he does that. And so is he going to go kill someone for $2,000? No, that's crazy. Okay, so it raises the marginal benefit of using violence against rival drug dealers, and it also lowers the marginal cost. And I sort of anticipated a little bit of this already. If you're, part of the reason it would be crazy if you're just a regular, you're running a drugstore, a normal like CVS or whatever, and you're selling aspirin and you're selling cold medicine and tissues and toilet paper, it would be crazy for you to go kill somebody because, like I said, we just pointed out you're not going to make that much more money, but also you would be ruining your life. You had a normal life. You weren't in danger of going to prison. You could move in certain circles. You could go to the opera. You could go to fundraising events for, childhood diseases and so forth. You could go on the golf course. People would say hi to you. You'd be fine. You'd be a respected member of the community. So you would be throwing that all away by killing somebody, or you'd be risk throwing it all away by killing somebody to make a piddly $2,000 more a year by taking out your rival owner of the drugstore across the street. So that would be crazy. But if you're a drug dealer, meaning like you sell cocaine, first of all, we've seen you might make $100,000 a year by killing the guy, so that's lucrative. But beyond that, on the margin, it's not that much riskier for you to do that, right? You already are doing things that could land you in prison if you misstep. You know, if you get on the bad side of the cops or whatever, you're already in a market where you're likely to get shot by other rivals who are trying to take you out. So you're already, you know, living very dangerously. And if you're a big-time drug dealer, you already associate with known criminals, and you're not a member of the, you know, polite society. Okay, people know who you are, and, you know, you're respected in certain groups, but, I mean, it's not like the mayor wants you sitting next to him at a fundraising event. Okay, so what I'm saying is, on the margin, the cost to you of killing somebody, killing a rival, is much lower if there's drug prohibition than if it were legal, because you're already, you know, taking such risks and so forth. And also, too, you already have the cops all on your payroll. You're paying off judges. So now, even if the cops know you killed a drug dealer, you're less likely to get prosecuted than if it were a totally legal thing and, you know, you weren't paying the cops off or anything, and then all of a sudden you go kill a guy, and then the police come to get you, and you say, oh, well, can I give you money to look the other way? They're going to say, what are you talking about? But if you already have been paying them off for years, and they know if you go to jail, they're going to miss out on that flow of revenue, they're going to be more likely to look the other way, even if you killed somebody. Okay, and then the last point is product purity. So here, there's a couple. So what the point, what the slide is talking about is that the quality and safety of various types of drugs will go down if there's a prohibited market. All right, so, and like talking about drug overdoses, like when I was growing up, one of the things that they used to try to scare kids straight to keep them off drugs was the story of Len Bias. He was this guy that he was like a star college player, and I think he had been drafted by the Celtics to go play basketball, you know, for a celebrated NBA team. And then he, I think, used cocaine at a party and had a heart attack or something. I mean, I might be fudging the details, but something like that. It was like the first time in his life he'd ever used cocaine, and he died. All right, and so that's, you know, people are trying to, you know, scare us little kids and say, see, don't ever mess with drugs because look what happened to Len Bias. He had a whole promising basketball career ahead of him, and he threw it away with one bad decision using cocaine, and that's how bad cocaine is. But actually, you know, if cocaine had been legal, I mean, don't get me wrong, it's not that it would be good for you, but, I mean, I think he wouldn't have died. That the reason he died is because he probably got something that had other stuff mixed in with it or whatever. I mean, I don't know the specifics of his case, but what happens typically in these cases where people have a drug overdose is that, you know, that they used it, they administered it improperly, or that it was impure, that it had something else mixed in with it. And that sort of problem is the result of drug prohibition. That's not the fault of drugs per se. And there's a couple ways of seeing that. I mean, one thing is, one way of seeing it is, look, right now, if you want to obtain illegal drugs, most people, what do? They have to go to somebody that they don't know very well, that does not have a stable address, and he gives them something that's totally generic. You know, it's like an unmarked thing. There's no brand name recognition, right, because no one wants to be traced as a drug dealer. It's not like a major company that, you know, has a scientific process and has tamper-proof packaging and so forth. So here's our cocaine, and we've certified this, and there you go. You're not going to have a heart attack with our cocaine. And, you know, you can, because the Brimley name is on it. Well, the Brimley name means this is good cocaine, right? That's not going to happen, because then the government would see it and say, okay, well, this guy Brimley is going to prison because, you know, he's blatantly selling drugs. And, you know, people in the churches around there would say to the cops, why don't you crack down this guy Brimley? He's advertising what a great cocaine dealer he is. And they kind of would have to. Even if he was trying to pay him off, they'd be like, you can't be so blatant about it. Okay, so that's the point. And so when you have these things where people are, you know, on street corners and pss, pss, here, all this stuff, I mean, there's no accountability there. It's very hard to maintain product purity. You don't know what you're getting. And so that's, and also too, things like, well, I'm just trying to think of a different way of motivating it, but just knowing what you're doing and so forth. It would be in the interest of the manufacturers for people to use their products properly. They wouldn't want there to be accidental deaths from the use of their product. So again, it's not to say that there wouldn't be bad health consequences, but like with alcohol too, I mean, the beer companies don't want you driving drunk and getting in a 15-car pileup. That's not good for their business. They don't like that. All right, so and they certainly, beer companies wouldn't want it to be the case that if you drank some of their product, you would die from alcohol poisoning after having just a few drinks. All right, and that kind of stuff happened under prohibition, under alcohol prohibition. People would be making moonshine in their bathtubs or whatever, and you know, people would die from alcohol poisoning because it's more dangerous to drink something that some guy down the street made in his house rather than drink something that a major company made under controlled laboratory or, you know, assembly line conditions. Okay, I will stop there. Do you guys have any, let me see the Q&A here. I see one question. We've got a few minutes for the questions. Jared asks, if prohibition or the drug war is a negative, would you agree that the drug dealing and corruption that circumvent the law are morally acceptable or even commendable? Is it not simply victimless entrepreneurship? Okay, that's a great question. I'm glad you raised it. So I think Walter Block would agree with you, and he would say, yeah, that's awesome. That wasn't a good Walter Block impression. I don't know what that was. Walter Block has this book, Defending the Undefendables, where he goes through and basically celebrates anybody who heroically stands up to the government prohibiting things that, in his mind, should not be crimes. I don't think that that's correct in general. So if the government is cracking down on somebody that I think is performing a very beneficial thing, then yeah, I think those people are heroes for risking what they're doing and risking going to prison or whatever. But I don't think, as a general rule, it's correct to say if the government is cracking down on something that I think, according to my, you know, either economic views or my libertarian political philosophy or whatever, if the government's cracking down on something using force that I think should not be a crime, I don't think it therefore follows that anybody who ends up violating those laws is morally commendable. And in one obvious way, suppose the government made cheating on your wife illegal. I wouldn't then say, oh, I celebrate now the heroic guys out there cheating on their wives. That's awesome. Stick it to the government by going and, you know, sleeping with your best friend's wife. That wouldn't follow, all right? So I would still say that's a bad law and it should be abolished. And, you know, I would feel bad for a philanderer who got thrown into federal prison because he cheated on his wife, but I wouldn't think he was a hero for doing that, and I wouldn't, you know, commend him for standing up to the government's crazy rule or, you know, crazy prohibition of you cheating on your wife. And so you shouldn't be doing that anyway. All right, so when it comes to drug dealing, it's a little bit more nuanced because, you know, I think there's a wide range of stuff. So, I mean, I went to college, I went to grad school and saw my share of illegal activities, and I know a lot of what American school children are taught in terms of, you know, this is what drugs do to you, that's largely propaganda. But, you know, somebody who's trying to sell heroin to a 5-year-old, do I think that guy's heroic? No. I think that guy's a scoundrel. But that's kind of an exaggerated thing. So that would be my answer to you, Jared, that I would not agree with your sort of blanket statement there. But I guess the concluding thing I want to say is, this is just another great example of how the drug war is causing the very things that a lot of people who are for the drug war think that it's preventing. What I just said there about, you know, drug dealers pushing drugs on little kids, I think that happens because of the drug war, or it's much more prevalent. You know, when there is that huge markup now, and every new customer really makes a difference, well, now there's a market for drug dealers to recruit eighth graders who go to, you know, certain schools that don't have a lot of discipline and have a lot of kids coming from broken families and what have you, and there's, you know, gangs and so forth. And now it's financially profitable to go recruit those kids to go sell marijuana or whatever to their classmates, whereas it's not good business sense for major tobacco companies to recruit eighth graders to sell cigarettes to their peers. Okay, I mean, don't get me wrong, I think the tobacco companies don't mind if young kids start smoking early, but I mean, they can't be actually pushing that and literally do, whereas drug dealers really will recruit young people to go sell illegal drugs, because, and to understand, well, what's the difference? Well, it has to do with all the things we talked about in this lecture. That the tobacco companies right now are legal, and they're actually, you know, they're sort of pariahs in one respect, but they're legal companies, they have shareholders and whatever, they have a public image to maintain. It's just not good business if it were discovered that R.J. Reynolds was literally, you know, had internal memos saying, and this is how we're going to, you know, get a bunch of products into the hands of eighth graders to sell to their buddies, that would just be bad. So they wouldn't do that. It would be silly. Whereas if you're selling marijuana, it's not like you're going to be hosting the Tonight Show anyway. You're already kind of a pariah, and why not do that? They make a lot of money. Oh, and also, last point, and then we've got to wrap it up here, is there are, you know, the sort of people that we think of as evil drug dealers, or that some people think of as evil drug dealers, that too is a consequence of the drug war, just like so-called slumlords are a consequence of rent control. That the system sets up these perverse incentives such that if you want to be a major cocaine dealer, you have to be ruthless. You have to be willing to kill people and so forth. It's not that dealing cocaine turns you into a monster. It's that given the way the market works right now and the various incentives, the only sort of person who's going to rise to the top and run a successful empire of importing and then distributing cocaine in the United States and paying off all the cops and all this stuff and not getting shot, I mean, it's going to have to be a really savvy person who's also ruthless. And so, you know, you shouldn't be shocked when you set up these incentives in place and say, hey, if someone's willing to do this stuff, if you're willing to pay off cops, if you're willing to shoot people, you know, if you're willing to do all sorts of unspeakable things to scare off potential competitors, and you're real savvy and can think two and three moves ahead of the average drug dealer, you can earn $5 million a year and have a bunch of guys following you around with guns and kind of live like a king within certain circles. And just not be, you shouldn't be surprised that some people step forward and say, yeah, I'll sign up for that lifestyle. So that's, okay, one last thing, because it's, George asked a good question. He says, what about medical marijuana dealers selling to patients who want it? Would they be heroes? Again, you're asking me, this isn't my views as an economist. You're just asking me my own personal, you could paint for me scenarios where I would say, yes, the person's a hero, and the scenario where I'd say, no, he's not. All right, that, so anyway, I'll just leave it to you. I think you'd see examples of both. All right. And for me to say someone's not heroic doesn't mean that I'm saying, oh my gosh, that person is such a scoundrel and how can he live with himself? I'm just saying the word hero for me, let's not debase the term by applying it to anyone who's willing to break a law. You know, I wouldn't say like, oh, somebody sped to work and broke the government speed limit, he's a hero. I mean, they just say, well, no, I understand why he did that. I might do that too. If I'm in a rush, it doesn't make me a hero. Okay, whereas, you know, like I said, you could come up with a scenario where some doctor knows he's going to get in trouble, but there's a guy with cancer who's just suffering greatly, and he says, you know what, I think that marijuana would really help ease this guy's suffering, and I'm going to do it even though I might lose my license and my career will be over, but I can't stand idly by and let this guy suffer. Well, yeah, that guy would be a hero in my book, right? But like I say, just the general fact that someone's breaking the law to do something that I don't think is that big a deal, that in my mind doesn't make the person a hero necessarily. Okay, we got to wrap it up, guys. Thanks for tuning in, and stay clean out there, kids. As my dad would say when I was growing up, you want to get high, go to the library and get high on books. My dad actually said that to me.